This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Do you have high blood pressure? Are you sure? Most people with high blood pressure have no signs or symptoms, even if their blood pressure readings get dangerously high.
In general, the lower your blood pressure is, the longer you live because it's less wear and tear on the cardiovascular system.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk about hypertension and how to avoid it or live with it. We'll also hear from the NIH about a new method of screening for coronary artery disease using MRI technology. And we'll hear a compelling story of how cops and other first responders in Chicago are changing the lives of mentally ill kids. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
And this is The Health Show. Okay, quick quiz. What are the symptoms of high blood pressure? If you don't have a ready answer, chances are that's the right answer. Most people with high blood pressure or hypertension show no symptoms, but they are at serious risk of heart disease, stroke, and a number of other health problems. And according to the CDC, almost a third of Americans are living with hypertension, and many don't know it. Here to talk about hypertension is Dr. David Meyerson, a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins and the Director of Cardiology Consultative Services at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center in Baltimore. I spoke with Dr. Meyerson and noted that checking for high blood pressure has to be one of the easiest medical tests to perform ever. So how can so many people not know they have it?
Well, they just don't bother. They look the other way. This isn't called the silent killer for nothing. High blood pressure is something that can affect many, many people, women and African American and Indian Americans and Hispanic Americans even more so. But it's such an easy number to know. You can go in the supermarket and put your forearm in a machine and know, or ask the doctor. But it's very important that you know, because so many diseases follow from this.
Now, we have the cliched picture of that type A personality, the stressed out businessman who has a drink in one hand, a cigarette in the other. Is that really the face of hypertension in the new millennium?
Well, that is one of the faces of hypertension, and that face is not going away. That's also the face of heart disease and early heart attack and early stroke and early death. But the face of hypertension or high blood pressure is now a lean, educated, 45-year-old African-American woman, doctor of philosophy, for example, who you would look at her and say, boy, she's active, she's lean, she does everything right, she still may have severe high blood pressure. High blood pressure doesn't know a gender, it doesn't know a race, it just knows that it ruins arteries. And in general, the lower your blood pressure is, the longer you live because it's less wear and tear on the cardiovascular system. I was just thinking about what happened when there was a big discussion in the media about women being screened for breast cancer and at what age, and women then being screened for uterine cancer and at what age. The American Heart Association supports the American Cancer Society. We encourage women to check with their doctors and screen accordingly, but a woman is 10 times more likely to die of heart and blood vessel disease than she is to die of breast cancer. Let me repeat that because it is the case and it is very powerful. A woman is 10 times more likely to die of heart and blood vessel disease than she is to die of breast cancer.
There are risk factors for high blood pressure that you can't control: age, race, family history, but there are a lot that you can control. Tell us about what some of the risk factors that, you know, might make you a candidate for high blood pressure.
Well, again, if you have a lot of high blood pressure in your family, you are at risk. And there are families, unfortunately, they will tell us that every uncle and every aunt that they've had has either on dialysis or had a stroke or heart failure. And when that happens, please don't believe that history will not repeat itself, because history will repeat itself. We can learn from the last generation that these are preventable diseases, and please let's do so. So knowing what your history is and accepting it and saying, I can't change who my parents were, but and I'll take the little additional things that they gave me that I don't want, like the high blood pressure, and I'm going to make sure that I identify that, I'm going to treat it. And especially for our diabetic patients, people with diabetes and high blood pressure get heart and blood vessel disease sooner than almost everybody else in the population. And you know, Bob, sometimes it's lifestyle things. It doesn't mean throwing a ton of medications at people. Sometimes if they lose as little as 8 to 12 pounds, if they reduce the salt in their diet carefully, if they reduce their alcohol consumption, if they're more active, and again, we're talking about activity that is an activity level that is appropriate for a given person. So I'm not asking our wonderful grandmothers to become marathon runners. That's not fair. What I am asking them to do is to walk as much as they can and as often as they can.
What are some of the other risk factors? We know being overweight is definitely one of them. Are there other things you can look at in your life and say, you know, this might be a problem?
Well, you know, those people who talk about white coat hypertension, and that is they say that only when they see the doctor wearing the white coat is their blood pressure high, and it doesn't seem to be high any other time. I have a feeling about that. And my feeling, Bob, is that life is a series of white coats. Let me repeat that. Life is a series of white coats. Whether you are driving your car and somebody cuts you off, or somebody sends you a bill that's 50% higher than the estimate, or somebody didn't credit something that they were going to, or a healthcare insurance company says, we're not paying for X care or whatever, and you don't know how to fight it. I mean, life is, this happens 12, 14, 20 times a day for most people. So what I would urge them to do is to accept the fact that this is the way they respond. And it's so-called a hot responder. And you have a little bit of a choice in this. I know that it's some people just fly off the handle, but you can either decide when somebody's going to cut you off, you're driving behind the car, thank goodness you didn't get into an accident, and you can say, oh my good, I don't know where they got that license, and kind of thank God we didn't get into it. It's, instead of getting into a shouting match and having you turn purple in the face and having your blood pressure go up to 240 when you're doing it. Let me tell you an interesting story about a 93-year-old man that was a patient of ours. He was doing beautifully. He was physically and mentally intact and active, and he didn't carry his clubs, but at least he could ride in the cart, and he could still hit a golf ball from time to time. And somebody asked him, what was his secret? Mr. Jones, what's your secret? And he says, well, my secret is this. He said, when it rains, I let it. And what I'm trying to say by that is that there are things that you can't control. We can deal with them a little bit better. But if you know that you're the type of person who is a hot responder, that the blood pressure is always up when you see the doctor's white coat, life is a series of white coats, and maybe that has to be taken a little bit more seriously.
Can you tell us the difference between primary and secondary hypertension? I mean, 90 to 95% of people with hypertension have primary, but what is the difference between the two?
That's a great question. It's very interesting, Bob, that the kidneys actually control how blood pressure is maintained in the body, that and some things in the brain, but largely the kidneys and the little glands on top of the kidneys called adrenal glands. And when the kidneys get enough blood pressure, the hormones that the adrenal glands and the kidneys secrete say, go ahead and get rid of fluid and go ahead and get rid of salt and things of that nature. And when they are getting too little blood pressure, then they hold on to salt and hold on to water and secrete hormones that elevate blood pressure. So a secondary cause would be something from an actual abnormality in the blood supply to a kidney or in some form of growth that is secreting hormones that are elevating blood pressure. But primary hypertension, to go back to the original question, primary is when we really don't have a cause. It just happens in a given genetic, in a given individual, in a given family. There's nothing specifically wrong with any particular organ system, and those people have to be very, very careful because they, again, during a lifetime, have an increased risk of stroke, of kidney damage, of loss of vision, of erectile dysfunction, memory loss, fluid in their lungs, angina, all of those things. The good news for secondary high blood pressure is that sometimes those causes are treatable. And if somebody does have a narrowing in an artery that nourishes a kidney, which is called renal artery stenosis, then that blockage could be opened, and a number of times the blood pressure will then either normalize or tend to normalize. And so the doctors can look for hormonal things or other vascular things which would cause high blood pressure, and those would be the secondary. And when you can't find a cause, that would be primary high blood pressure or primary hypertension.
Dr. David Meyerson is a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins and director of cardiology consultative services at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center in Baltimore. Still to come, screening for coronary artery disease may be as easy as MRI. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1299.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Testing for heart disease or the potential for heart disease can go a long way towards keeping this killer out of our lives. Now, a new imaging technique may make screening for coronary artery disease easier and more accurate. Joe Belinfi from the National Institutes of Health explains.
Coronary artery disease is the most common type of heart disease and is the leading cause of death in the United States. Coronary artery disease happens when the coronary arteries, those are the blood vessels that supply blood to the heart muscle, become hardened and narrowed. This is due to the buildup of cholesterol and other material called plaque on their inner walls. Plaque buildup in the arteries can lead to serious problems, including heart attack, stroke, and even death. Researchers are now investigating a new way to look at these arteries before any symptoms of coronary artery disease appear.
So it's almost like trying to image a spaghetti on a trampoline.
Dr. Ahmed Gharib at the NIH explains, capturing images of the blood vessels of the heart is a challenge.
The problem with looking at the vessels that supply the heart is, as you can imagine, it's a smaller vessel. It's about 2 millimeters, and it's sitting on a moving organ, which is beating at least 60 to 90 beats per minute, which is also sitting on the diaphragm, which is what we use to breathe.
But the results of a study using magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI technology, are promising. Dr. Gharib says the new technique is almost cinematic in the way it can capture one still image that is close to perfect.
It's almost like imaging a race car, and it's moving very fast. So if you take one shot at it, your chances of success is less than if you take multiple shots at it. Your chances of getting an image with less blur increases.
Researchers have used the MRI technique to measure the thickness of coronary artery walls in 26 patients who have at least one risk factor for coronary artery disease. They also measured 12 patients with no risk factors.
We found that this technique is quite successful, not in imaging them, but also is sensitive and more precise in separating the two groups.
Dr. Gharib points out that other imaging techniques involve some risk, including exposure to radiation, whereas this MRI-based option has virtually no risk at all.
It just goes in the scanner, and there's no contrast or dye involved. It's just simply going and lying down for 30 minutes or so.
Researchers emphasize that currently there is no reliable way to non-invasively image coronary artery disease in its early stages, when the disease can be treated with lifestyle changes and medications to lower cholesterol. The potential for this technique, says Dr. Gharib, is early screening to directly detect hardening or thickening of coronary artery walls, which is a direct measure of early-stage coronary artery disease.
So somebody with risk factors or thinks he has, you know, problems in that area might come and look at their vessel wall in the coronary arteries and see if it's thickened or not. At a certain point, if it is thickened, then we can say, okay, this is a little bit above the normal.
Dr. Grebe notes more research with this technique is needed to better identify exactly what a normal thickness is for coronary arteries. But if validated, another potential use could be to test the effectiveness of a drug or other intervention.
Now I can actually see if this is working, if what I've done has resulted in improvement in this vessel wall.
For more information on this research, visit niddk.nih.gov. For details on coronary artery disease, visit nhlbi.nih.gov. This is Joe Belinfi.
When mentally ill young people get into trouble with the law, the first responders to the situation have a tremendous responsibility. The way they react often has a large say in the future of those troubled kids. Joe Dassault from WBEZ in Chicago has the story.
As a 13-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department, Julie Joyce has seen her share of violent kids. Kids who are abusing their parents, or siblings, or others. Kids who appear to be out of control. And at that moment, she realizes that police officers have a decision to make.
If somebody is in danger of hurting themselves or others, then we have to take the proper steps to address that. And I call it talking a person off a ledge. That's how you should kind of talk to them. You know, which side do you want them to go over? Do you want them to fall off the end, or do you want them to come to safety?
She does everything she can to bring them back from that ledge.
I talk about my personal life, and I tell them, I really do understand what you're going through. No, I'm not sick myself. No, I never suffered a psychotic episode, but I know what it looks like, and I know how much you're hurting. And I'm here really to help you. I'm not here to hurt you. So whatever it takes, whatever I can come up with. Sometimes we'll have to stand outside and smoke for a while, or sometimes I have to sit on their couch and talk for a while. And sometimes they'll just stand there and scream in my face and call me all kinds of names. But I think at the end of it, they realize that I'm not leaving, and I haven't yet jumped on them or tackled them or cuffed them. So I think it does build that level of trust a little more.
What Officer Joyce often tells the subject she encounters at work is that she brings personal experience to roll call. She has an 18-year-old son at home named Christopher who suffers from ADHD and bipolar disorder. And he's had a rough time. Early on in his illness, he was wrongly diagnosed and improperly medicated. It was corrected, but soon came adolescence, and with it, hormonal changes that only added to the complications of living with his disorders. Add teen angst to the mix, and it equaled fits of rage.
I always joke about that. I am a professional. I'm a professional spackler. I can fix anything with spackle, Gorilla Glue, and duct tape.
But it wasn't just the mental illness that Joyce and her son were trying to cope with. It was dealing with a system that offers few options when things get bad.
Now, when Christopher was first in the hospital, he's 12 years old. 12-year-old boy who has to be searched, strip searched. He wasn't there for drugs or trying to kill himself. He was there for medication adjustment. They don't tell you what's going on. The only time they call you is, let's say, they called me at 1 in the morning and say, "Hi, Miss Joyce, we had to restrain your son for 15 minutes and 2.5 seconds, and then we shot him up." Taking him to a hospital when he had to go, it killed me. It's like taking your child to jail. You know, like, my kid did nothing wrong, and he would say that. What did I do wrong? And I would say, you did nothing wrong. We have to get your medication fixed, and I can't help you. And it breaks your heart.
Many families dealing with mental illness refer to the lack of dignity and sensitivity they often face at the hands of figures of authority. Little training or understanding of the complex needs of those living with mental illness can often exacerbate a tense situation. This issue exists in many areas of authority, including police departments. That's why agencies like the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, suggest public safety officers undergo training on how to deal with mentally ill subjects. Suzanne Andrikaitis is the executive director of NAMI of Greater Chicago, and she says that when NAMI first approached the Chicago Police Department, they said,
"Nah, we don't need that."
But the incidents continued, and it became clear to people inside and out of the police department that something needed to be done. So they looked at Crisis Intervention Team Training, or CIT. That's a program devised to teach police officers to de-escalate a situation, improve safety, and provide crisis prevention. It took a few years, but this led to a pilot CIT program within the CPD. And the program was a success by most measures.
In the year and a half, 2 years that they evaluated the pilot program, they documented 465 encounters between CIT-trained officers and individuals in the community who were having a crisis, a mental health crisis. And there were no injuries to the individuals either. So both of those things together convinced the Chicago Police Department that, you know, this was a good program.
By the mid-2000s, with the help of NAMI and others in the community, Chicago established its own Crisis Intervention Team Training Program. And it's since expanded from the several dozen officers that trained in its pilot program to today, where hundreds of officers have received CIT training. CIT officers work hard to prevent mentally ill subjects from ending up in jail. They redirect them to services in the community or hospitals. But it wasn't until a few years after it launched that Officer Joyce heard of the CIT program, and it was a perfect fit. A marriage of her passions, and she jumped on the opportunity. Following her training, Joyce began working with fellow officers who wanted to expand their CIT program into a new area. They worked once again with NAMI and other stakeholders to develop a program for kids and adolescents.
It wasn't just our ideas, it was everybody's ideas. So I think collaboratively, it's an excellent program, I think. And it was also great being the first department in the nation to do it.
They now had an advanced CIT training program for youth. And Officer Julie Joyce even asked to participate on one of the training panels. But she didn't do it alone. She had a partner.
I told my mom I would talk, I would answer any question whatsoever.
We did it together the first time, sink or swim. And it was amazing. He was amazing. He really surprised me.
They asked me things like, how do you react? What are your triggers? How can we as police officers and how can we as crisis workers, how can we react to something like this, and how can we help cope with the situation?
The decision to go in front of her fellow officers and reveal so much of her personal life, including talking about her son's mental illness, wasn't an easy one for Joyce. A lot of stigma is attached, but it's worth it. For Christopher, for Officer Joyce, and for her brethren in blue.
One guy was very happy. He came up, he was like, you know what, to be honest, I'm not going to lie, I thought this program was dumb. Came up and he said, thank the Lord I met you.
But that's happened numerous times, I think, hasn't it?
Or yeah.
People have thanked him and hugged him and told him how proud they are of him.
Right? Slipped me $20 in the back. You know what I'm saying?
And for Joyce, the rewards of watching her son connect with fellow officers like that meant a whole lot more.
Just seeing that, it's almost like he graduated from Harvard. You know, like I can only imagine what a parent feels like when their kid graduates from an Ivy League school, but that's kind of how I felt. Like, look at him. Because if you would have asked me when he was 5 years old, if we would be sitting, you know, here or there or anywhere, I could have told you we wouldn't know what we were doing tomorrow. I mean, I could never fathom that we would come this far and that he would be on this journey with me. By doing the CIT training, he's also speaks more openly, especially around his peers. So now his peers have started to look at him like a role model and reach out to him for help. So it's kind of going full circle.
What was the car ride home like after that first time together?
I just told him how proud I was of him the whole way home. And then he asked me what was to eat. But I also told him, you know, that the one thing that officers would remember was what he said. When they're on the street, they're always going to remember, your voice is going to be in their head. Do this, don't do this, try not to do this. That will stay with them for the rest of their career.
And that story comes to us from Joe Disseau from WBEZ in Chicago. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.